All right. So, well, and also what I want to say is that this is really, I'm really trying to make this an introductory talk. So again, please, if something is unclear, please stop me and ask questions. So I want to tell you something about scattering amplitudes in maximally supersymmetric Young-Mills theory, which many people in the scattering amplitudes program are working on. And just by way of introduction, let me say that this the maximally supersymmetric Young-Mills theory in four dimensions, n equals four super Young-Mills, it's a very special theory because it has many symmetries. And some of the symmetries we can see by looking at the Lagrangian. For example, one can see that it's a conformal theory. And let me just put this down. Has a conformal symmetry. So this is true for the classical theory, but it's also been shown that it's true quantum mechanically. So which means that it's beta function as a and on the coupling constant vanishes. And so we have an interacting conformal field theory, which is, of course, a very special situation. But then on top of that, there are other symmetries which are sort of surprising. And the idea of the talk today is to tell you what these other symmetries are. And but also since I think it's interesting to remind you of how this original conformal symmetry works. Now, this is all related to the fact that there are interesting dualities between different objects that one can study in this theory. So since that is related, I just wanted to give you a brief cartoon of what these objects are that are all related to each other. So what are interesting quantities that we can compute or study in a Young-Mills theory? Well, clearly we want to have gauge invariant quantities. So let's just make a list of some gauge invariant objects that come to our mind. So obviously, given the program title, there are scattering amplitudes. So on shell scattering amplitudes, they are gauge invariant. So we have some incoming massless particles with momenta p. And go all the way around, so we can have an n-particle scattering problem. So there's momentum conservation, some of the pi equals zero, and usually we consider massless on-shell particles, so they have this on-shell condition. So that is one interesting object one can study. But then there are also other quantities. So one of them are in fact Wilson loops. So what's a Wilson loop? Well, we can consider the vacuum expectation value of some Wilson loop, which depends on a contour C, where we have the path-ordered exponential of the gauge field A of x, which is integrated around this contour C, and to make it gauge invariant, we can choose a closed contour. And there should also be the trace, because in general we have a matrix valued field where A is in the UN of the gauge group. This is a UN gauge field. It depends. There are different choices of this contour C, and there are special contours that are important in the context of dualities, which are special contours Cn, which are just polygons, so which are defined by some coordinates xi, and as I said, we want to have some closed contours, so this is a closed polygon, and so that's another interesting observable, and there's a third object which is also interesting, which are correlation functions. Correlation functions of local operators. So, So we can make another gauge in an object by considering elementary fields. So say we have a consider some scalar fields phi I. So
scalar
it didn't
fields suck.
You don't like scalar fields? So I didn't say this before, but because of the supersymmetry, of course, we don't only have the gauge fields, but also fermions and scalars. But what happens is, because of all this supersymmetry, it doesn't really matter which. But you know, all of the fields in the Lagrangian of n equals 4 superangles are all interrelated. So given your preference, for example, when we consider scattering here, we could consider scattering of gluons, but in, because of supersymmetry, we can relate that to other components. So given, well, if somebody prefers gluons, they can scatter gluons, and other people might scatter scalars. So it's not all that that relevant here. So anyway, so there's some. We have actually six scalars and the six real scalars in the Lagrangian of n equals 4 supersymmetries. So I have some SO6 index, and as I said, they're all matrix valued because we have the we live in this gauge group UN, and so if you want to make some gauge invariant operators, we can do that by taking a trace of a product of such fields. So like for example, we can have trace of phi I phi j, and just let me just choose a definite SO6 representation. So I just remove the trace. So that would be a nice gauge invariant composite operator. And now what one can study is correlation functions of such operators. So you can study some object Gn which depend on some positions x1 through xn, and which are just the correlation functions of such of n such operators. And of course, I didn't specify, but one can choose some specific values of the ij in this example. So these are all interesting objects that one study in the gauge theory. And the amazing thing that happens in this maximal supersymmetric theory is that they're all interrelated. So for example, there's a duality between Wilson loops and scattering amplitudes, where these coordinates x here are related in a specific way that I'll show later to the momenta entering the scattering process. And then, moreover, there's another relation which takes you from these correlation functions here in a special limit to the Wilson loops. And of course, because there's this relation between Wilson loops and scattering amplitudes, this also means that you can consider a more direct relation between correlation functions and scattering amplitudes. So I find it really amazing that in this theory, all these objects are interrelated. And so I won't motivate why these dualities, some of which are conjectural, why they take place. But it is just like supposed to be an advertisement that there's really some very interesting structure here. And what I will take from this picture is a motivation why there should be more symmetries than this conformal symmetry, because actually what will happen is that. If you look either at the correlators or Wilson loops, they suggest that there are more symmetries which act on the space of x variables. So that will actually lead to this dual conformal symmetry, which I'll tell you about. So there's also this. So we'll find, or we know by now, that there's an additional symmetry which is another copy of conformal symmetry, but which acts on different variables, as I'll describe, which we call dual conformal symmetry. And now, when you have these two copies of symmetries, you can also ask the question: what happens if you start commuting the generators of the symmetries? And there's an interesting structure which appears, which is that the combination of these two symmetries gives rise to a Youngian algebra. And So let me just to make a comment to connect to just to Nima's lecture, let me just say that there's obviously one can study all these objects in different variables, and depending on what you do, they're good variables to do this and that. Let me just say that in a particular set of variables, so-called momentum twister variables, schematically, you get a very simple form of these Youngian generators, and schematically, let me just write it here. Schematically, what you get is that these dual conformal generators, they look just like Z, dz. I'm leaving out some details here, some indices. And you have some additional generators here which take this form ZZ, DZ, DZ. So, and this is of course very, it's very helpful that that there's such a formulation where the symmetry generators take this simple form. So you had a question?
Well, again, what can you say about beyond planar level?
Let me just comment on this in a second. I was going to make a couple of comments. Indeed, so it's thanks for this comment. Let me say it right now. So this conformal symmetry is actually a property of a Lagrangian. So it's true for planar and non-planar scattering amplitudes, for example. I forgot to say this dual conformal symmetry. Actually, it is. It is restricted to the planar, so the planar case, so the large n limit. However, there are some things one can, how one can put this to use also for the non-planar case. So, let me just make that comment now. Some comments. I mean, what is this good for? Well. So these symmetries they heavily restrict the planar theory. I mean it's obvious when you have such a huge amount of symmetry that will give you a lot of restrictions, and we're going to discuss some of them in a bit. But it's also known through the work of Svi and collaborators that there are certain ECJ relations, which roughly speaking relate the planar scattering amplitudes to the non-planar scattering amplitudes. So in that sense, you can you could take this viewpoint that the symmetries help you to pin down what happens in the planar case, and then you have some other relations which help you to transport that information also to the non-planar sector of the theory.
The ECJ you can define as a symmetry transformation. There is an algebra.
Well, I think the way it works in practice is that you can. There was a talk by Henrik. Johansson a couple of weeks back. So the way it works that you can start from some integrals, say planar integrals, and then apply these ECJ relations, and you discover that then you also need non-planar integrals for consistency, for these relations to be satisfied. So if you have as a starting point the planar integrals that contribute, then from them you can generate the other integrals as well. At least in all, as far as I know, in all known cases, that is that is what happens. In principle, you could have a situation that you have a sort of a set of non-planar integrals which is closed under BCJ relations, so that you could start from one integral and you apply the relation and you find that. You would never find a planar integral, but as far as I know, there's no example known for this case. Maybe I don't know if somebody in the audience could comment on that. I think it's definitely something which is very useful in practice, Of course, there's more fundamentally, one would like to ask, is there, does this, you know, could you make this more formal? Could you translate this in an actual symmetry of a non-planar theory? But that hasn't been solved yet, as far as I know. Another comment I wanted to make is that is where these symmetries actually apply. Now, I said this is the symmetry of the Lagrangian, but now depending on what objects that we compute, sometimes we have to introduce regulators. Like, for example, scattering amplitudes for massless particles that have infrared divergences. So we have to deal with those divergences. And introducing a regulator often breaks symmetries. So that is why, a priori, this symmetry here, the conformal symmetry, is only or is best understood at the moment at tree level. And similarly here, the dual conformal symmetry is certainly valid at tree level, but maybe paradoxically, it's better understood than the original conformal symmetry. It's actually also understood at loop level. And there are different ways of understanding this at loop level. One which uses some word identity to pin down what the breaking of the symmetry is. And there's actually another way which uses certain masses to regulate the infrared divergences, which allows also to preserve the dual conformal symmetry at loop level. So paradoxically, we understand this mysterious new symmetry in that sense a little better than the original symmetry. But I think it's also an interesting problem because this is it would be very worthwhile to understand this, the breaking of the original conformal symmetry, even better in the loop level of the theory. So now. But coming back to tree level, so both of these symmetries apply to tree level amplitudes, and they heavily restrict them. So in particular, when you there are some lectures by Roof on recursion relations for tree level amplitudes, and what these symmetries imply is that the result that you get out of these recursion relations must respect all these symmetries, and although it may be not mandatory, but I think it's definitely fair to say that was very helpful in solving such recursion relations. So, so if you have the recursion relations W for either trees or loop integrals, these symmetries they tell you in advance that the answer will be very simple. And that is of course very helpful in solving the solving these relations. So I just put down easy or easier to solve. Another comment along these lines is that although we're talking about a supersymmetric theory here, of course the perturbative expansion of a supersymmetric Young-Mills theory doesn't really care so much at tree level about the fact that there are scalar particles and fermions. So in fact, the tree level solution for BCFW also implies that you know tree level amplitudes in other theories, including massless QCD. So also implies that effectively these symmetries help you for determining tree level amplitudes in non-supersymmetric theories. All right. Okay, and that, as a last comment, I already mentioned this. As I briefly said, there's also a formulation for dual conformal symmetry in a massive case where you can actually give some vacuum expectation values to some of the scalars in n equals 4 super Young-Mills. So there's a way of having massive particles in this theory and have at the same time this dual conformal symmetry. Yeah.
Okay. The massive particle, of course, scattering amplitudes like this are not teaching them by yourself. At the point, we have also to include wave function normalization.
the question is, this massive formulation takes care of
it. Yeah. So there are different answers to this question. So one would somehow have to for some of them I'd sort of have to go a little bit in the detail, but let me just so there are two answers. So the first answer is that in this maximal supersymmetric theory, at least in principle, you can choose some setup, a supersymmetric, a superfield formulation, where actually you don't have to worry about wave function normalizations. So that is one part of the answer. The other part is that there's a setup where you actually, you have massive particles, of course, which are the massive W bosons when you do the Higgs mechanism, but you also have still some unbroken part of the gauge group and still some massless particles. So in practice, the setup that one can contemplate is the following, where you have some massless particles which interact through the exchange of massive particles like this. So schematically at one loop you might have this kind of process. And then you just have the usual it's just as gauge invariant as a completely massless scattering would be. So actually it's not really an issue in those cases. All right, so that's what I wanted to say as an introduction. So now the plan is to show you some examples of how these two symmetries work in some very simple cases, just to give you a flavor of how we can use them. Just continue there. So let's just begin with the conformal symmetry. And as I said, since the symmetry is broken by infrared divergences at loop level, let's just stay at tree level for a moment. So let's just think of how this conformal symmetry works at tree level. So actually there's some very since we're at tree level, it doesn't really matter, but we have this supersymmetric theory. We could actually use some toy model. Let's just take the simplest conformal invariant model that we can imagine classically, which is just a phi to the four theory. So let's consider scattering amplitude in phi to the four theory. Now, how do we see that scattering amplitudes in this theory actually have a conformal symmetry? So that question is actually related to how we define scattering amplitudes. So let's again imagine a four particle scattering of scalars this time. So how do we actually define this? Well, you would write down a correlation function of four scalars in coordinate space. In coordinate space we have this conformal symmetry, which just follows from Lagrangian. But then to get to a scattering amplitude, we'd actually Fourier transform that, amputate the external legs, and then put the momenta on shell. So there's really a chain of operation that one does. But and I won't go through them in detail, but one could do it in principle. But the main message is that following through this chain of operations, you can start from the form of the conformal generators in position space, and going through these steps, derive what their form should be in momentum space. So this is the first comment. The second comment is that in position space, conformal symmetry is a symmetry which is linearly realized. So you have first order operators, but so they would look like so in position space. So let's say the position space is obtained from Fourier transforming the piece like this, and let me call y the position space coordinates, just to distinguish them from the x's I'm going to use later. So in position space, a conformal generator, schematically it would look like something like y dy dy, and there are also other terms of different contractions of indices. Should have just one derivative, of course. So it's a first order differential operator. Now, the main point is when you go through a set of operations I mentioned, we're going to do a Fourier transform to momentum space, and then basically this will turn into dp, dp, and this will turn into p. So it's clear that in momentum space, this will turn into a second order operator. So what is the conformal generator in momentum space? Can just go through this these operations which I mentioned, and you will find the following: minus 1/2 p mu d nu plus p mu d nu mu plus d mu, and so here this is of course d is just a shorthand for d dp. And so this is actually this is a one particle representation of the generator. But of course, for scattering amplitude, we have to sum over the generators which act on each individual scattered particle. So there's a sum over I here over all of the momentum. And then the statement is that when you act with this conformal generator K on such a scattering amplitude, that you have to get zero. And again, this just follows from the conformal invariance of the Lagrangian. Well, just for completeness.
Sorry, in fact, before you encounter, there is only four coupling, no? There is no three coupling.
Yes, I'm assuming just that the Lagrangian should be just have this interaction term, and then otherwise it's just the kinetic part. That's right. Right, because this is a classically conformal, because the coefficient here is dimensionless. All right, and now so just for completeness, you can also do the same with the dilatation generator, which is somewhat more trivial. But just for completeness, let me give that form. It's sum of the pi and the dpi plus 1. So just as a comment, to get this constant here right, you have to take into account this amputation of the external legs, which slightly shifts this value here, and it also gets modified as you when you Fourier transform. All right. So now we can use these generators and see how they actually this condition here is realized. So. Let me just give you the two simplest examples that one can think of. So first would be just the scattering of four scalar particles A4, which at the lowest order, so we're discussing tree level here, so at the lowest order we just have this one Feynman diagram. So it would be given by, well, the coupling constant from this interaction term, who maybe want to normalize it by some factor here, but well, up to a constant is g times, well, times what? So we have we said we were going to amputate the external legs. So actually, there's no factor coming from these propagators here. However, there's a small additional term, which is the momentum conservation delta function. So we just have delta 4, the sum of the four. Entering momenta. So this just simply comes out from these Fourier transforms. And so now the statement is that d on this A4 is zero, and also k on A4 is zero, just as a consequence of the conformal symmetry in position space. So the reason I'm mentioning this example is because it's a first case where you can see how these generators here act on this delta function. So I won't do this now on the blackboard, but I think it's quite interesting to see how this works. And just to give you another example, let's look at a six particle scattering. Now for six particles, I could have Feynman diagrams which look like this. So we'd have P1 entering here, P2, P3, P4, P5, P6. Depending on which scalars we choose here, we could also have symmetric, versions of this diagram obtained by symmetry. Or alternatively, we could choose some of these SO6 labels just to have this diagram here. Whichever way you want, whichever way you like, it will have this conformal symmetry. So let me just focus on this first diagram. So this diagram would be given by sort of g squared from the coupling constant. Now all of these six external propagators would be amputated. So in this case, we'd be left with this middle propagator here. And this is just given by the square of the sum of these three momenta here. So we just have p1 plus p2 plus p3 all squared. And importantly, we also have the momentum conservation delta function, which this time is a sum of momenta which runs from 1 to 6. So the reason I'm giving you these examples are twofold. So one is just to give you some simple examples where you can explicitly see how these equations work. And the other reason is to say although I'm not going through this in detail now, is to show that actually this is not at all obvious. Because now here for example, the statement is that this K, which now acts on in the sum which acts on all the six external momenta on this A6, again it gives zero. And it's definitely true, but it's not at all obvious. And the reason it's not obvious at first sight is that this is actually a second order operator. So this is what makes these conformal symmetry generators a little difficult to handle in practice. And and this is really the reason, I think, why the dual conformal symmetry in practice is so much more helpful up to this point, because it's realized, as you will see, as first order differential operators. But of course, there's also this original conformal symmetry, which works in the way I'm describing here at tree level for these scalar amplitudes. But it would be really important to understand better how it works at loop level. All right. Yeah.
You're not using any of the spinner variables we learned about in the last couple of days.
Excellent. So let me just make a comment and relate to that picture. Actually, indeed. I have to admit I haven't been a good student. I skipped some of Roof's lectures, but I think you probably solved for MHV amplitudes using PCFW, right? Okay. So let me make a. Because now these were amplitudes in the scalar toy model, just because of simplicity. But actually, we can formulate the same. Let me make a third example. So now let's go back to Young-Mills.
Sure. Can I ask you something before you go to the Young-Mills?
Absolutely.
Now very explicitly everything. Is that any paper you have done this work of writing this phi to the fourth theory with BCFW recursive equation? I've asked this question, I didn't get an answer yet.
So let's see. There are two things one has to bear in mind. So for BCFW, of course, it relies mainly on two things, on complex analysis, some very nice analysis of the structure of poles of tree-level amplitudes. But also to set it up, there's this, you have to analyze what happens under the shifts, the shift parameter, as it said, the shift parameter goes to infinity. And actually, the behavior of amplitudes under these shifts is much better in gauge theories compared to scalar theories. Just for example, in this case, this amplitude, apart from this delta function, is just 1. So it doesn't fall over infinity. So that's why for scalar theories, it's not as simple to use these BCFW relations. Now, on the other hand, if you have a scalar model like this, the tree-level amplitude is actually so simple that you could basically just write them down. So maybe given that you don't actually need it.
Just because I'm a bit ignorant, in these prismatic theories, you do have a sector which is scalar, no?
Yes.
But then you still can use the BCFW.
That's a very good point. And then the reason is that supersymmetry, as I said, it relates everything. So even though you have some scalar components.
There are the type of vertices which allow you to get the right behavior.
That's right. Yeah, it's well, roughly speaking, it's just because it's related to the good components which have this good fall off at infinity.
One more question about the scalar theory. So at least two things at least I learned from this example A4 and A6 is that first, the delta function alone is conformally invariant. Second is that a propagator, the massless propagator alone is also conformally invariant.
Yes.
And this actually holds beyond the scalar theory, right? That's true.
Well, maybe I'm not on.
It's only conformally invariant for 4 pi.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, there's some slight. You see, this delta function is slightly different from one that's written here because it's we have a different number of particles, and also this generator here is slightly different because in this case it has 6 terms, whereas in the other case it has 4 terms. But let me just
k act on the delta function of 6 moments.
Yes. You see, the argument is a little different. But actually, let me just make another comment because I was going through this a little quickly. When you actually check how this is working, there's an issue because this is a second order generator. So there are various terms that you can get here. And generally speaking, what happens is you will have some terms which act on the delta function. But then, with those terms, you can trivially see that they annihilate this object in the distributional sense. It's basically just a question of having an object which has the right dimensionality. So in other words, if you have this delta function here times some function which has the right dimensionality, you can always commute this generator k across the delta function. And then essentially what you have is that k alone acting on this propagator here gives 0. But it's still important that this propagator, you see, it's not just any propagator. It has the sum of the free adjacent momenta. So somehow k manages to annihilate this. So what I'm saying is you can commute k around this delta function, and then you just have this equation, which just holds on its own. And again, as I already stressed, this is sort of it's if somebody hands you this equation, it's not completely obvious. You actually have to do some calculation to see that it's true. All right.
This equation alone, where does the fact that these are three nearby momenta come in? Because your k mu is completely symmetric.
There was also some. Well, okay, maybe here it's not so important. Is there any? I guess so. In this case, you actually, in general, you it may be important that you have momentum conservation, but I think in this example, probably it doesn't matter, because
that's in 4 dimensions.
This is in 4 dimensions, correct? Yeah.
So that's the Fourier transform 1/x², and all you need for conformal invariance in addition to scale invariance is inversion.
Okay.
Actually, I mean, in conformal invariance.
Absolutely, and this is indeed where this came from. So this is indeed the point. I mean, when you look at these graphs in position space, it's completely obvious that they're conformal. But then, if you try to formulate it as a differential condition on momentum space amplitudes, it turns into these slightly ugly second-order conditions, and these are then not so obvious. Of course, if you wanted to prove this, it's best just to go to position space. Yeah, absolutely.
I think the key is what you said, and it's easy to just look at the dilatation operator instead of k, because d, for example, for the case of 6 particles, sum of the 6 terms. So when you act on that, you have the extra 1.
Yes. That's to get the dimension right.
Do what he said, just come.
All right. So just to wrap this up, let me make this connection to the BCFW lecture. So you computed the MHV amplitudes in a Young-Mills theory, and so what do they look like? So if we have some amplitudes with negative elliptic gluons in position I and j, say, then you have the overall momentum conservation as usual. So sum of the I goes from 1 to n of the pi. And And then you have this nice Park-Taylor formula. So just spinner products 1, 2, 2, 3, all the way to, n minus 1, n, and then n, 1 again. And upstairs you have this factor I, j to the fourth power. And so just in case you want to see now how this formula manages to be conformally invariant, let me just give you the form of the of k of the conformal generator expressed in the spinner helicity bands. Actually, it's a little simpler than the form I gave over there. So you just have a sum from I goes from 1 to n of partial derivatives, one which acts on the lambda variables, I alpha, and the other partial derivative which acts on the lambda tilde variables. Just as a quick reminder, what were these brackets here actually? So one, these angle brackets are just contractions of lambdas for beta. So actually in this formula here is a little special. This is a feature of the MHV formula, that you have no lambdas here, but you actually do have some lambda sitting in here. So let me just remind you that p mu, you can write it equivalently with alpha dotted and undotted indices, and it's just a product of the undotted and the dotted spinners. So this is actually a very special case, because here the fact that this is a second order operator is not so does not play such an important role, because actually one of the partial derivatives always hits this delta function. And so one can use this generator and act on this amplitude and find that it's indeed annihilated, which is again the expression of conformal invariants. So for this, if you want to see how this works in detail, it's a short calculation, but there's some you have to bear in mind that this works in the distributional sense. So you also have to, for example, you can have some contributions which are p delta p something like this, which then are zero in the distributional sense. So that's the only thing you need actually to, given this, then it's easy to show that this holds. If you want a reference, this was done explicitly in a paper by Witten in 2003, this famous twister space paper. All right, so so I think that's all I wanted to say about the original conformal symmetry. Are there any questions at this point?
This k written in this form is a special to MHV in some sense.
No, it's completely general. What's special here is just that the MHV amplitude mainly depends, in this way I've written it only on the lambda variables. But of course, secretly through the delta function, it also depends on the other variables. So k is completely general, and the statement is general. K annihilates any tree-level amplitude in Young-Wills theory. What is special about k is that this is, of course, here we're using a four-dimensional spin helicity formalism, whereas the k that's written here, that's actually also four-dimensional, but it would be very easy to generalize this to d dimensions. Actually, the only thing that changes here is the prefactor of this term here. So in d dimensions, this would be d over 2 minus 1, which is happily is 1 in 4 dimensions. So this form of k is simpler because we're in 4 dimensions. This is, looks a little more complicated, but it's also more general. So it's it helps make sense. That depends on what metric you're considering. So in general, you can consider them complex and independent. That's right. But often when we, especially when we use BCFW recursion relations, for example, we like to think of the lambda and lambda tilde variables as complex and independent actually.
Being able to generalize
generalize this conformal symmetry to two dimensions, this shouldn't be enough to solve also the problem of studying beyond the three level, because one could use dimensional generalization is to study the conformal symmetry also at the level.
Yes. So, what I said is that it's easy to write down the conformal generator in d dimensions. Of course, you also have to have a model which has this symmetry. Now, for example, if I just take my phi 2 4 model and say now the Lagrangian lives in d dimensions, that model would no longer have a symmetry. See, so this was sort of you also have to have a model. So mainly, what we can use this for is, for example, if you had another six-dimensional model of phi cubed interaction vertices, then this would be the good generator just for d equals 6. So the problem is really is there some way of can you find a model which has the symmetry in d dimensions? But it's sort of orthogonal to the idea of regularizing, which always introduces a mask game. So I think one cannot really avoid the problem of a breaking of a symmetry, but really the question is, can one control how the breaking occurs? All right. So now maybe an erase over here. So now I'd just like to make to show you how this dual conformal symmetry works. And as I already emphasized, my main point is that actually it's a symmetry that is much easier to handle because it's not second order in the derivatives. It would be just first order derivatives. That's why it's so useful. And the first point in understanding this. The symmetry DCS is actually what's very important is to make a good choice of variables, and that's actually a choice of variables which is a good choice in general if you have planar scattering amplitudes. So imagine we're scattering, we're considering a scattering process again, the momenta ingoing like that. Now, what you can always do is actually introduce some new set of variables, which is defined in the following way. So if we have these external momenta which satisfy the momentum conservation condition, we can always do a change of variables and say that the PI should be given by some differences of so-called dual or region coordinates. So these x I call dual or the region coordinates. And what this does is identifies this configuration of momenta actually with a polygon, just as it's written here. Actually, I didn't have to draw this again. And so now the differences between two dual coordinates here are just the momenta which we had in the scattering amplitude. So you start with some coordinate x1, and then you define x2 and x3, x4. Define the following dual coordinates in this way, and at the end you will arrive at a coordinate x n plus 1, and the statement of momentum conservation is just then saying that this polygon should be closed, so that x n plus 1 is the same as x1. So when you hear at xn and you go to the next coordinate xn plus 1, this polygon actually closes. And so this is something you can always do when you have a planar graph. And so one of the messages that actually independent of the symmetry, that's always a good idea of doing, because these are nice variables for planar graphs simply.
The fact that p and x have different dimension, I should just
Well, actually, I didn't. Indeed, you should just ignore it. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
One could call these X's.
You could call them K, or, yeah, if you liked. Yeah. I mean.
You want them to be coordinate.
They have the same dimension as P, but it's actually not important. Yes. But so you should just ignore it.
It's not a space coordinate. So these Wilson loops are not Wilson loops in space time.
Well. Well, I think the short they are, but the short version of the answer is this point really doesn't matter, so you shouldn't worry about it. Well, I hope that's so let me just show how this works on this on some generic planar graph. So if you have a one loop integral here, we could say that we have let's say we have the loop. The loop momentum, which is integrated over here between Pn and P1, we can make that choice. And then the next propagator would be k plus P1 squared, and then k plus P2 squared, and P1 plus P2 squared, and so on and so forth. And now, when we do this change of variables, it's also convenient to do a change of variable in the loop integration variable. So now let's also say that k, we're going to go over from k to some new variable, let's call it x0 minus x1. Let's check I'm doing it the right way around. Yes, that should work. And so now let's just do this change of variables on this integral. So now the loop integration will be over this variable x0. First propagator will just be x0, 1, all squared. So I'm using some shorthand xij is just the difference between xi minus xj. And then we can see the next propagator will be x0 minus x1 plus x1 minus x2. So it would be just x0, 2 squared, and then so on and so forth. So we'll have x0, 3 squared, all the way to x0, n all squared. So you can see that that's already quite neat notation-wise. And so just as a last comment on notations, let me also say that using these coordinates, it's also very straightforward. For example, if you wanted to Feynman parameterize this graph, there's a actually there's some nice group theory here, but let me just tell you the result. So if you were to look at the Feynman parameterization of this graph, so you'd have some it would be proportional to some integral over Feynman parameters. So you'd introduce a Feynman parameter for each of these propagators. And then really what the Feynman parameterization is telling you is what the how this factor that you have to integrate over looks like. And so the point is just that it's completely straightforward and simple to write down in these coordinates. It's just a sum over I smaller than j of all xi minus xj squared, so xij all squared, multiplied by alpha I alpha j. And that's actually everything. And then here you have the sum over the number of propagators, so we'd have n here minus 1/2 the dimension. So this is obviously, this is some trivial fact, but it's just to illustrate that these are nice coordinates that are useful for planar graphs.
You're using DIMRAG as a regulator?
Oh, well, this is just a very general example. So D can be anything. Could be 4, could be something else, yeah.
I guess I'm asking, so whatever regulator you choose, it's not going to spoil your dual conformal symmetry.
Oh, well, that is a very good point, but this will be important indeed. But at the moment, I'm just making a comment about these coordinates. So we I'll discuss what the relation between D and the symmetry just in a minute. So flat right here. So for a moment, the message is just that these are good coordinates for planar graphs. But now, indeed, how does dual conformal symmetry come about? Well, so it's again a conformal symmetry, but this time it doesn't act on the coordinates which are associated through Fourier transforms with the scattered momenta, but instead it's a symmetry which acts directly on these coordinates, dual coordinates x. So we just have the again a set of conformal symmetry transformations. So just as before, we have a dilatation. Well, I'll use the same letter. I think it's too late to change, so I'll just use the same letter again. D, this time it's the dual generator, which so x goes into lambda times x. Then of course there's an infinitesimal version of this, and just as before, there's a special conformal transformation. But actually, just because just for simplicity, let me consider inversions, which are equivalent, which just take x to x over x squared. And so now the statement is that there are certain planar loop integrals which have simple properties under these transformations. And so the idea is to find out which ones have these nice transformations. And in order to find to answer this question, we can first study what are covariants of these symmetries. So what are quantities which go into themselves up to some multiplication factors. So first thing we can ask is what happens to the integration measure under such inversions. So under inversion. And so just doing a change of variables, one can find out that this produces a factor of x squared to the minus d. Now, what other quantities do we have in such graphs? Well, we have these propagator factors, so differences between dual coordinates. And then it's a simple calculation to show that this goes into itself again, divided by xi squared, xj squared. So this also transforms covariantly. More generally, we can also have other objects, traces of certain chains of dual coordinates, xab, xbc, cd, xda, where what I mean by trace, so x here is really just supposed to be the vector x dotted into some gamma matrix. So again, using these inversions, one can show that these traces are covariant if the labels of the dual coordinates are if the adjacent dual coordinates share a label. So in that case, this goes into itself again, say B, B, C, C, D, X, D, A. And again, one has just some covariance factors, xa squared, xb squared, xc squared, xd squared. This is actually important for the kind of integrals you're seeing in the lectures that Nima is giving, where one has structures like this which appear, albeit in some different, written in some different variables. So to jump ahead a little bit, these are exactly the structures which one sees in n equals 4 superangles. But okay, let's go slowly. Oh, what do I mean by trace here?
It's gamma matrix.
It's a trace of a gamma matrix, that's right. All right. So these are nice objects. Out of these objects, we can actually build conformal, dual conformal invariants. Let's just look at an example. A very basic example is, again, our one-loop integral. So let's try that down again, and let me make it a little more general. Let's say we have, again, n propagators, so a product from j going from 1 to n of x, 0j all squared. But now let's generalize a little bit and let these propagators have arbitrary exponents aj. And now we can ask what happens if we start using, oops, I shouldn't call this I, let's call this j. So we can ask what happens if we use inversions on this integral, and is it actually is it covariant under these inversions? Now, when we start doing inversions, well, we'll pick up, we'll find that all these factors here are covariant, but they spit out some x's here, so we can actually just write it down. So we'll have inversion applied on this integral j. So we'll give us first term with, we'll just get the same object back, so j squared aj. And now we have a collection of factors coming from the one from the propagators and one from the integration measure. So we have x squared to the x0 squared to the minus d. Then we have a number of x0 squared coming from the propagators here. So we have x0 squared to minus, sorry, so this is downstairs, so we get it to plus the sum over all the ij's. And then we also have a product j from 1 to n of the xj squared to the aj. So now what we see is that this factor here is innocent because we can just pull it out of the integral. It's not being integrated over. It just depends on the external points. But what's important here is what happens to this x0 factor. So we see that exactly when d is equal to the sum of the aj's, then we reproduce the integral we had before. So if d is equal to the sum j from 1 to n of the aj's, then we just get our integral j back times this covariance factor here, j equals 1 to n xj squared to the aj. So, and in that case, this is an example of a dual conformal covariant integral. Actually, it would be simple to make it invariant by just choosing an appropriate numerator factor here.
And of course, this is a statement that phi of the d is a scalar phi of the d is conformally invariant.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Sorry.
Yeah. Well, it's exactly that you. Well, it's a little more general because you can have arbitrary powers of indices here, but in particular you can have you have to take into account that the dimension of the propagator is not always one in X space, but it's so you can see using this for example that if you have in six dimensions, for example, these AJs in position space would be two. And then you have indeed that the sum is equal to 6, and this is just saying that that indeed scalar phi cubed in 6 dimension is conformal. And similarly you can generalize. Okay. So erase this. So now, before making the connection to n equals 4 supersignals, let me just say that having integrals which obey the symmetry is something very nice, because these integrals have to be very simple. This symmetry constrains them a lot. So maybe actually let's stay with this d equals 6 example, just to show you that a special case of this is something which is well known. It's called the so-called star triangle relation for n equals 3. So if you have a three-point integral such as this one, so you have let's say we have dx0 in 6 dimensions, just to stay with this example, x1 squared and 2 squared, 3 squared, all squared. Well, actually, in this case now, I... Excuse me?
Loop integral now, so it's not literally the stream, but it's from my computer. What's the integration over D here?
Oh, so the integration is the integrator of this point, x0. Actually, yeah, so, and then you have the coordinates x1, x2, x3 here. So how this came about was from this change of variables, which actually associates this picture where you integrate over some loop variable. It transforms this into a vertex picture, which actually I didn't write probably, so it's a good idea to... thanks for this question. So let me just draw this other picture. So this formula is associated to this picture here, but now the one that we have here is actually some associated to some other picture, which is a star-like picture where you have the dual integration point sitting in the middle. And then all these external points joining up with the dual integration point. It's 1, x2, x3, all the way to xn. So this change of variables just takes you from this picture, the usual picture you use for loop integrals, to these dual pictures here.
Right, and I just integrate over the position on the dual space.
That's exactly right, yeah. So in practice, actually, I didn't show this here because maybe it's easiest to do this algebraically, but what you can do is you can, there's some graphical rule, basically, when you have a loop, the new integration vertex here will sit in the middle of the loop, and then these dual coordinates will sit in between the external momenta, just because of this this definition here. And then... now, of course, these were propagators, so now these just turn into these dual propagators here. So that's how you go from the loop picture to the star. Okay. So now this, what I want to do is just to give you a very simple example of how this dual conformal symmetry can be helpful. The reason that that is helpful is that you know in advance that if your integral has the symmetry, the answer must be given in terms of covariance and invariance of the symmetry. So for this simple three-point integral here, we can first think of what would be a function which has the same covariance properties as this integral. So as we saw just before, this object here would be covariant with a factor of x1 squared, x2 squared, x3 squared to the second power here. So we can just write down something on the right-hand side which has the same properties. And a very simple object is just x1 2 squared, x2 3 squared, x3 4 squared. Oops, x3 1 squared, sorry. And so now the left-hand side and the right-hand side have the same covariance properties under these inversions. In general, now we could have a function here of some variables, let's call them ui, where the ui are dual conformal invariants. So in other words, we could have an arbitrary function of invariance under the symmetry, which are left invariant if we do an inversion. Now, the main point now is that in the three-point case, there are simply no conformal invariants that you can write down. So no invariants for three points, and therefore this function f here. Since there are no invariants, it must be a constant. So in other words, the symmetry immediately tells us that this three-point integral, which otherwise we'd have to compute somehow, it's just a constant divided by these factors, which we could predict based on the symmetry. And now, this is, of course, a very simple example, but you can imagine that basically the same restrictions will still be very helpful if we have integrals which depend on more external points. Basically, it simplifies our life a lot. It simplifies a lot calculations of higher point integrals. All right. So now, the idea here was to show you how this symmetry works, and I haven't actually said so much how this actually appears in n equals 4 sweeping wells. And actually, there was already some question about regularization, and there's some important issues here, of course. But the main idea here was really to show you just what is the symmetry and what are the transformations, how these work in the purest form. Now, in n equals 4 sweeping wells.
So far, you are just looking at inversions because you want to keep it simple,
So I could talk about special conformal transformations. These integrals which we're dealing with, obviously, they have a translation symmetry. So, as is well known, the special conformal transformations are equivalent to translations and inversions. The reason I'm using inversions here is just that it makes this analysis of what are covariant objects much simpler than using infinitesimal transformations. So it's but all these statements here, they could be formulated in an infinitesimal form as well.
Uh-huh. Maybe a dumb question. So this is kind of a difference of positions, which looks sort of like a derivative. Is there sort of a second derivative type generalization, or? N goes to infinity, does it become a derivative and reduced to formal invariance?
I don't know.
Imagine xi plus 2 minus 2 xi.
Well, maybe if what you're asking is there a good generalization of this to non-planar graphs, which unfortunately I also don't have the...
Dual. It's just
I guess I don't. I'm afraid I don't know. So just to remark again on this question about the inversion. So I could completely equivalently just use the special conformal. Transformations in the infinitesimal form, which would look. Now I apologize again, but I'm using the same notation as before, which would look like something. The main point that now it's a first order derivative, so you'd have xi xi d xi with some. I don't recall now the exact contractions of the Lorentz indices. It would be a first order. Differential operator, and that's actually very important, as I emphasized before. That makes this the symmetry much easier to handle compared to original conformal symmetry.
The same thing happens to apply to the three-order stuff. Or?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. So indeed, so here maybe it's a little confusing that I actually introduced this for loop-level integrals and. Paradoxically, it was found first at loop level, and maybe the reason is that it's there's one simplification I was doing here, which is I was looking at scalar integrals. Now there's a generalization of this to which also involves the lambda and lambda tilde variables again, but in that case it really requires discussing supersymmetry. So that's actually why historically this symmetry was first found at loop level, actually in the loop expansion of MHV amplitudes, because as we saw a little earlier, I erased it already. These had a very special dependence on the supersymmetric these are a very special class of amplitudes which sort of lets you forget about supersymmetry easily, and that makes the life a lot easier. So all of this has an extension to the general case.
You do x variables and then you apply this to this MHV amplitude and you get the game symmetry.
Yes. Again, there's a small subtlety which you have to define an analog of this for the supersymmetric variables which are associated to V. So there's some supersymmetric extension of this which describes n equals 4 sweeping mass. But apart from that, you just get a generator which annihilates the G-level amplitudes.
I mean, I think we should tell people that there is a simple string explanation of this.
Uh huh.
Yes.
Yes.
Makes it clear why it's very hard to understand this field theoretically.
Well, the origin of this.
In fact, it was sort of discovered at the same time in the string problem.
That's right. Yeah. Also, what the string theory makes obvious is that this is something which is. One reason it's easier to discuss in string theory is because this works for the plane amplitudes only. And of course, string theory has a nice separation between leading color and subleading color, which is not so obvious if you want to have a Lagrangian description of scattering amplitudes, for example. So, the origin of this is still a little mysterious in field theory. It's definitely a symmetry of the amplitudes. As I was emphasizing, it's a very useful one because it gives you very simple differential constraints on amplitudes. Now, to finish up this this talk, let me just come back to this initial point of how this was actually discovered. So, to give you some glimpse of how this actually appears in n equals 4 sweeping mills. So in particular, if you look at the loop expansion of a 4-point scattering amplitudes, and so a 4-point is by definition there's only an MHV configuration. Then you can just for convenience, let's define a quantity if you have the full 4-point amplitude. Let's just factor out some tree-level piece and then define some piece M, which actually is a scalar function of the two Mandelstamming variables, S and T, in that problem. So S is just P1 plus P2 all squared, and T is P2 plus P3 all squared. And this quantity M actually has an expansion in terms of loop integrals, which are very much the form that I was describing. So actually, what one gets is that M. I won't bother too much about normalization. So first order is just 1 because we pulled out the tree level factor, and then at one loop, G squared here. But again, I won't worry about the factors. It's just this one loop 4-point box integral here. And now you can immediately see that this box integral it has 4 propagators, so each of the a's is 1. They sum to 4, and so if we are in 4 dimensions, actually this has this dual conformal symmetry. Now, as was already marked, there's an issue because one has to regularize, and these issues are actually understood, but I won't have time to go through it in detail, but let me just say that since D is roughly 4 and we have 4 propagators here, actually our criterion applies, and this integral, it knows about this dual conformal symmetry. Again, there are many details to fill in here, but it's probably too much for this introductory lecture. But just to illustrate, so now at the two-loop level, you again get some very simple results. Just basically some two-loop ladder integrals, and now so this is a generalization of the case we looked at before. Now we can have since we have two loop integrals, we have to introduce two dual integration points here, and again one can do the counting. It's basically just that we have boxes, which tells us that again our criterion for dual conformal symmetry is satisfied. And you could think this is some kind of accident because we're at lower loop order, but actually you can go on and look at the loop expansion at 3 loops, 4 loops, 5 loops, and this actually continues. So you only get integrals which have these properties. So at 3 loops you get these these ladder integrals, which are obviously, again, dual conformal because they're only built from boxes. And then you also get something a little more interesting, which is the so-called tennis court integral here. Some people call it the squash court integral. And so now what we have here is, you can see again, we have two sub-integrals which are boxes, so our criterion is satisfied for those. But there's a seemingly there's a problem because we have this pentagon sub-integral here. And so if it were just the scalar integral, this would not have this symmetry. But luckily, there's actually a numerator factor, which is a little hard to draw, actually. So if this is, let me get it right. Right. So, what's the factor? I think it's right. If I call this loop integration variable k, and this is some other propagator which now I'll call just q, then there's a this diagram has actually a numerator factor which is q plus k all squared. And what this means is that if we go back to our counting here, that we have, it's like an inverse propagator here, which, so we have five propagators downstairs and one upstairs. So again, our counting is valid. So the upshot is that all these integrals that you see in the expansion of loop amplitudes in n equals 4 supernodes, they have this property. Now just to... This is planar, yeah. This symmetry only appears in a planar sector. So now just to finish off and make a connection to Nima's lectures, so this is the four-point case where you have these nice scalar integrals. Now it turns out that if you go to a higher number of points, it's very convenient to use integrals which have tensor structure in the numerator. So maybe we saw a glimpse of this here already because we had this inverse propagator. More generally, in the numerator, we can have also traces of dual variables which are defined like this. And so in this example, we had just had a trace of four axes, but we could have more. So you can write down further generalizations of dual conformal integrals. And so let me just mention that at two loops, for the endpoint MHV amplitudes, this turns out to be just actually given by a sum of integrals, which have a following form. So you have some double pentagon integrals of, in general, many external legs. So in the most general case, you can have I think it's actually 12 external legs here, and the sum here actually goes over the different different possible configuration of external legs. So in there are some special cases where actually you don't have legs here, and this reduces to a box times a pentagon or even double boxes. But this is just the most general class, and so the statement is that the two low amplitudes are just given in terms of this this topology of integrals. And
I'm trying this here after the OPP type reduction.
You're referring to some integral reduction to some basis of integrals. So the well, actually, that's a very good comment here because there are different forms of writing loop amplitudes, of course. So you can choose to write down these integrals, or you could do some transformation and represent them in different form. So what I'm saying here, this is...
I'm just asking a really
yeah,
question.
Yeah.
So the vertices in the middle don't exist, so what are they?
Oh, okay. Where does this come from?
Yeah.
What you're saying is that this is not an... Okay, well, so where this comes from and where this could come from in the Feynman diagram, of course, is some, you know, you have some Feynman diagram, and then since you have, in general, numerator factors, they could cancel some propagators, and then just, like, you know, move, then you have effectively more vertices entering a lake. Or just another example, if you have some, let's imagine we had some one loop graph like this, then this up to this external, this is just an external factor. So equivalently, I could draw this like this times some rational factor. So it's I think it's just that. All right. So now these integrals are double pentagons, and just as in the case of our tennis court, and glad that Nima appears when I'm discussing his integrals. So there have to be some numerator factors which make this this dual conformal invariant actually. So what I mean by these wavy lines is actually something well along the same spirit of these inverse propagators, but it's in this case it's more like something which is built from traces like this. So you actually in the form that we have discussed, they're equivalent to traces, but it's actually much more convenient to use these twister variables I remarked upon on the very beginning. So it's actually a very neat way of writing this. But the main point is just that you have some numerator factors which compensate for this additional factor from the fifth propagator here, and these integrals all have this dual conformal invariance. All right, so I think that's a good place to stop now. And
Johannes.
Yeah.
Your whole story is based on the fact that you can introduce these new variables to incorporate momentum conservation very easily.
Mm-hmm.
But in one of Nima's papers, right, he uses the lambda-lambda tuto variable. Mm-hmm. The momentum conservation is just two hyperpoints in some space being orthogonal to each other. Is there some relationship between the two stories?
I'll talk about it, yes.
Okay. This.
Yeah, I mean, the plane story makes all the symmetries manifest. So the conformal symmetry and the dual conformal symmetry manifest at the same time. But I'll talk about it in the second part of my lecture.
So I think I'll just stop here for this introduction. So thanks a lot for your attention.
Just to draw a picture, I mean, you draw a picture for the box which should be across when you do
it. Uh-huh, right, yes.
The double box would be what?
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's a lot of fun drawing these pictures. So let me. So thanks for asking, because I really love drawing these pictures. So this was a box. This was a star. So now we have. You see, we did do this change of variables, one each for each loop integration variable. So now we have two dual loop integration points. Again, we just have the four external points: x1, x2, x3, x4, which sit here. And now we just connect. So there was a propagator here. So this comes this.
Johannes, that's too small, man.
Oh yeah.
I'm gonna draw this man.
Indeed. Yeah. Indeed. So. Okay. So we have the dual integration points, the dual external points. And we just connect, because here we have propagators. Like this. So we get this nice picture. And actually, let me just for fun also draw the tennis court, because it allows to illustrate something very nicely. This point about the numerator. So we have again the dual integration points, external points. Now we connect again everything. So now we get a different picture. You might call it a butterfly or whatever your imagination suggests. And so now there was this issue that this dual point was joined by five propagators here. And so now if I wrote down this numerator correctly, so I said it's a scalar product, the sum of these two momenta. So now if you go through this change of variables, actually it will be a numerator which goes from this integration point here to this external point over there. So we usually these numerators we use some dashed lines for drawing them. And in this representation, of course, it's then immediately obvious that this has this dual conformal property.
Yes, but somehow this is not diagrammatical because the loops are somehow the loops in the.
Well, this dual picture, you shouldn't think of it, of loops, but rather of the number of loops here is the number of these integration points. So it's something actually which is there natural from this point of view of correlation functions in position space. Actually, if you were to this looks very much like an integral that you can get if you compute a 4-point correlation function in position space. That's where you would naturally draw these pictures, and actually, as I said in the very beginning, the correlation functions in position space actually are related to scattering amplitudes in a limit. So that's
even the very simplest 4-point box.
Uh-huh.
The dual diagram is just an X, and that's just the
phi to the four correlation function in position space. Yeah, that's right.
That also explains why. We don't normally see the correlation functions computed in position space, even for the most trivial thing in phi-4 theory, because the answer is a dialogue.
Yeah. Or be it a nice dialogue.
I was very nice. Except
more questions?
Does the original conformal symmetry always imply the dual conformal symmetry?
No. A priori unrelated. It's a little mysterious. There are some cases where actually you have integrals which have both symmetries, which are quite fascinating. But a priori, it's unrelated.
So you could
it just
have
happens.
A non-conformal symmetry that has a dual conformal symmetry.
Yeah, you could imagine, but I mean, it's just that we don't have so many examples of that.
Absolutely, don't worry about Lagrangian. Mm-hmm. Because how the heck would the Lagrangian know that in a single color trace meets at least there's a symmetry? This is utterly invisible to Lagrangian, and also because it's clearly not local. So there's no way you could see
it. Well, how do you know it's not broken at 7 loops?
Because for n equals 4, we know the integrand to all loops now, and it's presented in the form that's manifestly Gang-Gang.
Johannes, this may not be a fair question. It's outside the scope of this whole program. But the previous question sort of led me to ask the following. The usual conformal invariance, of course, is immediately generalized to curved spacetime. Can the dual conformal invariance be similar?
Well, actually, there's a very nice way of thinking about the dual conformal symmetry in terms of string theory in ADS space. So that's actually what's related to the other question of how do we know that the symmetry is there, especially at loop level, is that when thinking about the string theory picture and there's a very nice ADS interpretation of that, which has to do with these massive particles which I mentioned in the beginning. So that actually allows you to implement that symmetry at the loop level without having to worry about infrared divergences. I'm sure it's related to this. Since we have correlation functions here also, and you can discuss correlation functions in ADS of bulk to boundary propagators. That's certainly related to these issues.
It's really remarkable. The symmetry could have been discovered in principle in 1955. It's a symmetry of tree level angles. And you have to work pretty hard to see it because of what he said, that even in tree amplitudes, it's a little bit, I mean, you have to strip off some factors in order to see it. It's easier to see it supersymmetrically. But still, had people computed amplitudes up to 8-9 points in 1955 for the hell of it, they would have seen something insane happening, that after some trivial factors were factored out, everything else grouped into things that had this dual conformal invariance. And another fact, which maybe Johannes mentioned it, but which is quite remarkable, is that the dual conformal symmetry is present in Yang-Mills theory in any number of dimensions, even though the conformal symmetry is not.
I see.
But the dual conformal symmetry is there in any number of dimensions. Above 4 and above, 4 tree amplitudes again. So it's remarkable that this hidden symmetry is a very general, and the conformal, the obvious symmetry is not.
But you know, in the history of physics, if you look at things the right way, a lot of things could have been discovered 100 years ago.
No. I agree with that, but I'm saying this is not, it's really something that's there. It's a property even of the non-supersymmetric pure loop. And it's sitting there, and when you see, when you, of course I agree.
Yeah. Could you be a little more explicit about the relation of these dual diagrams to the evaluation of the pulling moments and loops?
Uh-huh. All right. Okay. So, oh, the dual diagrams. Okay.
Did I understand this right, that the dual diagrams, the X space that they're in, is the space of the corners of polygonal Wilson?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So,
you would give the explicit statement, I would really appreciate.
Okay, yeah, I can certainly do that. Now, let me just draw this cartoon again, so we have the scattering amplitude of the momenta, P1 through Pn, and importantly this relation that Pi was defined as the difference of these coordinates. And then the Wilson loop, I didn't say it explicitly, but it's defined as some contour Cn, which is just a polygon in this dual space. So in this is, for example, the six-point case. But generally, we have n points. And so here you have the, in the simplest case, you have the MHV scattering amplitude here on this side, which then, I just try to make it very explicit. So we have the tree factor, and then we have this object M, which I discussed over here. And on this side, you just have the vacuum expectation value of the endpoint polygon Wilson loop. And now the statement is that there's a duality between these two objects here. Now, so roughly speaking, this is the same as that. Now, I can be more explicit what I mean by roughly speaking, because actually it's a, there's just one issue which one has to bear in mind, that these scattering amplitudes here, they have IR divergences, whereas these polygonal Wilson loops, if you compute them, you find some diagrams like this, which lead to EV divergences. So actually it's a priori, it's a little confusing, how can one be the same as the other? Maybe the best way of phrasing this is that for both objects, here the IR and there the UV divergences were well understood. Here the IR divergences in the planar limit, they have to combine into certain wedges. You could remove them using form factors. So you could remove these infrared divergences in a well-controlled way. Similarly, here for the UV divergences, there are simply renormalization group equations which tell you how these UV divergences have to look like. So for both objects, there's a well-defined way of removing the divergences. The divergences have to exponentiate in both objects, and then the leftover is some finite quantity which you can compare in both calculations. And I think that's the best way of phrasing it. And then the duality says that the finite part which you compute is the same in both calculations. And it's very surprising because at the kind of diagrams you compute here, if you have some six-point Wilson loop, you know, you have diagrams which just at one loop level are just a single propagator. Whereas, imagine a six-point one-loop scattering amplitude. You have many Feynman diagrams.
So even in this dual picture, the diagrams don't look like.
There are certain special there are Wilson line diagrams. So here you have some, you integrate over this contour here. So the gluon propagators are integrated along the.
There's no relation between these diagrams.
There's no direct relation between this diagram and the Feynman diagram.
The diagram contribution to this.
Well, in some cases you can, I mean, since there is this duality, it sort of suggests that there's also a technological way of seeing that, you know, that diagram should somehow map into the other diagram. And in some cases we can actually see how that works. So in particular at one loop level, it's a little more complicated at a two loop level where not everything is understood. But there is a way of seeing how this kind of diagram actually maps to some, if you just had in the four-point case, or more generally, for MHV amplitudes at one loop level, you get these two mass easy integrals. And now there is a way of doing some well, I could call it tricks in the Feynman parametrization, which lets you transform this loop integral into a line integral, which looks like that. So there is some, I mean, this duality also pays off at the technological level. You know, you asking such questions, you uncover some nice relations between integrals, indeed.
But perhaps I can add that this sort of this most intuitive direct way of thinking about the Wilson loop is attaching propagators between the two edges, literally computing e to the I, the expectation value of e to the I, the integral of a dot dx around the loop. That does not give you an expansion that looks like a loop expansion. But there's another way of thinking about computing the expectation value of a Wilson loop, which involves it's simple to explain.
Yeah, maybe.
But yeah, maybe you can explain it. It involves an idea of using Lagrangian insertions, yeah, which literally turns it into a loop integral.
Yeah.
So that second way of thinking about validating the Wilson loop literally looks like a loop integral. And then you have integrands that you can compare.
Yeah.
Then the statement that the integrands are actually exactly the same, even ignoring infrared burden issues, all loop orders, the integrands are exactly the same.
Yeah, up to some d-dimensional issues. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
But indeed, so this what Nima is saying is that you can formulate the what is this Luckey expectation value of a Wilson loop? Well, you would compute it using a path integral over the over the gauge field, and then you have the action here, and so there's a coupling constant here, probably actually a 1 over g squared, Yang-Mills squared. Now, if you want to compute the one-loop expectation value, what you can do is you can differentiate with respect to the action. So it's this insertion procedure, because it's called insertion because when the action comes down and you have to compute a new object, which is the action inserted into the Wilson. So schematically, if I denote the action by this cross here, it will sit here in the middle of the, will cut the gluon propagator into two parts. And then there are two things you can do. You could either do this action, of course, comes with a space-time integral. You could either do this integral and you could get back the Wilson loop, or, alternatively, you could decide to carry out these line integrals here, and then you would get something which looks like that.
You have that nice formula.
There's an object that looks identical on both sides.
You have that nice formula for the Feynman parameterization. In this picture, is there a nice geometric interpretation of the Feynman parameters alpha?
Here you have some line integrals over some parameter which one could call alpha and beta, and actually these are related to, indeed, to, as you say, these are related to a certain way of introducing Feynman parameters here. That would be yet another way of stating this relation, which doesn't make use of the Lagrangian insertion. So yeah, it's really quite fascinating. Many relations between different looking forms of integrals. And then this is also very helpful because one form, like for example this form, may be much easier to evaluate than another form. So this also pays off at the technical level.
When you take the one loop integrals and you Feynman parameterize them, then you first have to recognize that Feynman parameter integrals are really to be thought of as integrals over a simplex and projective space. When you think of them in that way, then many things become obvious. One way of evaluating the integral actually is recognized as computing a volume in ADS. Another way of computing the integral is recognized as computing some correlation function on a surface in ADS. Another way of computing the integral is a Wilson loop. But sort of different ways of using Stokes' theorem on the same basic object lands you in all the different equivalent forms of arriving at, because this is an important point about the way loop amplitudes arise. Loop amplitudes are massive total derivatives in this business. They want to just be zero. The only reason they're not zero is because of infrared issues, is because of reality conditions, but the integrand itself is a complete total derivative. And that's why there are so many zillions of different ways of writing it, because you can use Stokes' theorem to write that total derivative in many different ways and hit it to boundaries in many different ways and get the different representative of the object.
Questions? If not, let's thank the speaker again. Yeah. Well, thanks for all your feedback. It was a lot of fun.